Did you know that the 4th of July is on a Thursday this year? That's going to be a full weekend of fun out on the deck, 4 days. But if your deck isn't what it used to be and you aren't using it for great family gatherings, you need to call my friends at All Weather Decks. All Weather Decks is a 24-time winner of the Angie Super Service Award. And they probably help one of your neighbors. Click on the map link at allweatherdecks.net. Call All Weather Decks today at 913-206-1974 or go to allweatherdecks.net and mention you heard it on 810. Call now and relax.
Impress your friends. Amaze your coworkers. Make your family proud. Here's what you need to know. I'm going to tell you what
you need to know. All right, team's coming back. Getting back to practicing and starting to get things going again. What does it all mean? Well, we've heard the commissioner, Bob Bowlesby, say that, you know, we're going to have some bumps, right? We're going to have some positive tests. Well, was it 2 days ago, Oklahoma State, 3 positive tests at Oklahoma State. Now reports coming out just in the last few minutes, at least the report I'm seeing. Maybe somebody else had it a little bit earlier. But a minimum of 5 Alabama players have tested positive for COVID-19. At least of the 5 participated player-led workouts Tuesday and Wednesday. At least of the 5. This is a poorly written thing. Somebody banged this out pretty quick. They participated, at least out of the ones that did participate in the player-led workouts Tuesday and Wednesday, 5 of them tested positive.
Oof.
That's a pretty big number, isn't
that
it?
That is a big number. When you consider the exponential spread of this virus, 5 in that group is big.
And out
he
of...
Was a, go ahead.
Just out of all of the programs that you could have it happen at, too, if you were going to have it Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, like, wow, not great. The best thing, actually, because they'll catch it. But
yeah, and maybe they can, you know, get it under control right now. Maybe it makes them more diligent. He was asymptomatic at the time, according to AL.com. Alabama ordered tests for every player in advance of June 8th. The day the SEC teams can begin holding voluntary workouts amid the pandemic, Crimson Tide coaches were reportedly not involved in coordinating the early practices. That's a fundamental problem, isn't it?
Yes. That's fundamental problem. That's an excellent descriptor.
Alabama has put out a statement, the health and safety of our student-athletes is a top priority. Resources and protocols are in place to ensure they receive the best medical care when returning to campus. Due to privacy laws, we cannot share information specific to the health of our student-athletes. Again, I'm sure somebody was just banging on the keyboard to get this out there, but a minimum of 5 Alabama players have tested positive. At least of the 5 participated in player-led workouts. It's probably missing a number, at least like 4 of the 5 or 3 of the 5. He's missing a number in there, I think is what it is. So something out of the 5 participated in player-led workouts. And this is what we've talked about. And you know what? I'm going to call a little bit of an audible here, Jed, as I'm wanting to do, right? Why wouldn't I? I want to get to the Eli Drinkwitz sound and give me number. Did you get? Oh, we didn't get it, Curtis.
Oh.
The one, that's all right, buddy. You were under the gun. Anyway, Drinkwitz was asked about, what was it? Any players not there, right? There was one, players not there. That was later on. Yeah, we didn't get to it. We ran out of time. My bad. But he was asked if any players were not there, and he paused. And I'm going to bring this back to Alabama here in a second. He paused, and he said, I'm not sure I can answer that. I'm not sure I can tell you that under NCAA rules, right? Because these are voluntary workouts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he's taking a roll call of who is and isn't there, how voluntary is it? That's clearly pressure. Well, this guy wasn't there. That guy wasn't there. The line of questioning was, has anyone called you and said, I'm not coming? And then it was followed up with, well, what about, you know, is anybody, you know, who wasn't there, who was and wasn't there? And he said, I don't think I can answer that, to which I think Eli Drinkwitz is very knowledgeable on the rules. And I think he's probably right. He's not supposed to. And it definitely would be condemning them as far as talking about, you know, how we've said it many times. How voluntary are these? I don't know why I can't. Remember how you put it, Dorian. What was the way you called these workouts when you were playing lacrosse at UConn?
Moptional.
Moptional. Mandatory optional.
Correct.
Moptional. I love that. The moptional workouts. So here you have these moptional workouts. Oh, they're voluntary, right? But yet all these kids come, but they're not supervised. Like, why would the campus, like, first of all, that's stupid to begin with that you can have voluntary workouts, because you know how it works, right? You know those kids. It's, well, you want to play? You want to keep your spot on the depth chart? Like, you better show up. You know that pressure exists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I brought it up with Jim Sterk when we had him on last week. And I think here we've got a case where the kids come back. Well, we've got all these plans, like Eli Drinkwitz, and I'm not getting on Eli Drinkwitz. It's not his kids that have tested positive, but I do wonder. I wonder how many people in America, when I watch these protests and how close people are, so many people wearing masks, that's a good start, but it's still not social distancing at all. It's outside, that's better than inside, but it's not social distancing. And the linebacker at Oklahoma State said he'd been in a protest in Tulsa, and that's where he thought he probably contracted the virus. Now you've got five Alabama players that have it. Now, it's early enough that hopefully they can work through it. They're healthy kids, and they come out the other end. They socially, you know, they distance everybody, and the team is, you know, this is a speed bump, you know, several months before the season begins, right? But these are the things. It's just stupid to have, well, you can come back for optional workouts. There's no option to it.
Yeah.
There's no voluntary to it.
The guys who don't show up are probably going to get passed over for those who do.
Just so frustrating. I mean, so obvious. Like the NCAA, which they're simply a representation of the schools. The schools want this. But it just speaks to, you know, how hypocritical the schools are. Don't act like you're all about the student-athletes when you're basically forcing them to come back and have these voluntary workouts that are not voluntary at all.
Yeah. Unless there's some legality, some reason that they have to refer to them as optional. We can't say they're mandatory, so we're going to have to say they're optional.
Yes, it's called rules that limit how much practice, and everyone
knows what it is, and they're using that to their advantage, and it's causing a ripple effect within every school that's out there.
Well, Eli Drinkwitz holding up all these policies and how they're going to do it. Well, those aren't followed when a bunch of kids are running the workouts.
Right.
Duh! Yeah. Not to Eli Drinkwitz, to the NCAA. Now, if you're just joining me, we've talked a lot about Eli Drinkwitz. I thought he was great today, and I think he's been on a roll here the last couple of days with how he's been conducting his team, and let's do move on. So five players test positive for Alabama, and they're not even really to the workout, so I think that is significant to say the least. Eli Drinkwitz was asked today. He had a Zoom press conference, and he was asked about bonding. What kind of experience was it having this march where they went to the courthouse, the team laid down for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, and then after that, 62 players went in. That's the number. Have we confirmed that? I know I've said that.
Yeah, I thought it was, and I went back and looked, and I did see a story that the number was 62.
62 players then went in and registered to vote. I don't know how you could be more proactive in a positive way than Eli Drinkwitz was with his football team down in Columbia. I was asked about whether or not this was a bonding experience, what he took away from being part of the march.
I want to be very careful. You know, the interaction with me and my players is between us, and it's not for anybody else. It's for us. And it was a powerful moment for me that changed me. And it was for me. It was for me to grow and learn. And so, you know, the interactions that I've had with my players about what's going on, that's for me to grow and learn. And it's not for public consumption, just to be blunt about it. I saw where George's daughter was on, I believe it was Steven Jackson's shoulders, and she said, "Daddy changed the world." And he has. And that's really what hit me, was he's changed the world. And this conversation is so much different than it's been in the past. And that's powerful. And it's changed me, and it's changed all of us, I believe. And I'm thankful, and I'm grateful, I'm grateful that I get to be close to such strong men on this staff, and I'm grateful that I get to work with them every day, and I get to have the courage to do the things that we did because of them.
We talked about Eli Drinkwitz a lot in hour number one. If you didn't catch that, Tiger fans, I hit the podcast, 810WHB.com, and, of course, on the 810 app, I think an impressive guy. I think Missouri's got a winner there.
It changed me.
Yeah, it changed me.
It's for me to grow and learn.
This guy talking about himself, and not much there, but when he did talk about himself, he's talking about how he learned, right? He changed. And I think that's clearly a guy that gets it, right? That's a guy that gets it. A guy who don't get it, or at least didn't yesterday, Drew Brees, who fired up seemingly the entire NFL and his own teammates who had him, who took to social media and were telling him to shut the blank up. Not a good situation. And Lewis Riddick was on ESPN today, and NFL analyst, you heard him on the program earlier this week, said the words of Drew Brees' peers certainly had an impact.
Drew heard the message. He heard the reaction. He heard the reaction from his teammates. He heard the reaction from people outside of the quote-unquote football world. He heard the reaction from society overall. And I think he knows and he realizes that he lacked a level of awareness and empathy that is necessary. It was necessary before. It's always been necessary, and it's necessary now. He heard his peers, his non-African-American peers, express that it was never about the anthem in and of itself. It was never about the flag in and of itself when Colin Kaepernick initially took a knee. It was about racial inequality. It's always been about racial inequality. And he, you know, unintentionally hijacked the message as it was hijacked before, as far as what Colin was trying to draw attention to by his comments to Yahoo Finance. He realized that the reaction that Malcolm Jenkins had was very authentic. It wasn't contrived. It wasn't made up. Malcolm wasn't looking for any kind of sympathy points. He was authentically expressing that, Drew, you missed the mark. You missed the mark as someone who was the face of our franchise, one of the faces of the National Football League, and most importantly, someone who I respect and look up to as a teammate and as a human being. And that was authentic pain that he was expressing right now. And that's what many African Americans are expressing right now. Authentic pain.
People have suppressed thoughts and opinions and pain for a long time, and it's boiling over right now. And, you know, you got to understand where that pain's coming from. It's not about you, and it's not about your grandfathers. That's not what it's about today. All right? That's not where we are right now. And finally, raw emotion is coming to the surface, and people who have been asleep to it or kind of asleep to it or ignored it are opening their eyes to it, and Drew Brees, one of those guys that had his eyes open when his teammates turned very vociferously against him.
In my life, the times where I think I've been the most upset, it has been when I have hurt someone that I care about. If I've said something, you know, my mom or dad or friend, when you say something, whether you meant or not, that someone that you love, it hurts them. That it seems to be the things that have had the most impact on me, and that could be part of Drew Brees' turnaround from yesterday, is that people that he cares about have expressed to him the term that Riddick said, authentic pain. When you feel that from someone, then that you've caused that or made it worse for them, that the pain existed somewhere else. That will turn you around, man. That will definitely turn you around if you have it within you to be turned around. And I'll take Breeze at his word that's what happened with him.
All right, and finally, for the first time since the inception of the ESPYs, ESPN bringing a select number of markets around the country the opportunity to award honorary ESPYs in various categories. Sports Radio 810 WHB, we are proud to announce that Kansas City is one of those markets. We're joining forces with ESPN to award honorary ESPYs in various categories right here in the Kansas City community and our surrounding areas. To cast your nominations, go to 810WHB.com. Write the name of the individual, organization, play, or moment. You'll see if you go to 810WHB.com. Click on it. Very easy format to fill in who you'd like to nominate. Nominations are unlimited and must be submitted by Sunday at midnight. So go to 810WHP.com. Click on the ESPYs. You'll see the ESPYs icon, ESPYs button. You can't miss it. It's right there on the front page, and you can submit whatever team. There's various categories there, player of the year, moment of the year, game of the year, all kinds of different things. You can also submit additionally by nominating, making your nominations via social media. Just put the hashtag 810ESPYs, hashtag 810ESPYs on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and we are taking those as nominations as well. Then we'll have voting on it. But only got till Sunday. This is really great. It's like five markets. Of course, New York, L.A., Chicago. I can't remember if it's Philly or San Fran or what it is in Kansas City. It's a tremendous honor. We're very proud of it here at Sports Radio 810 WHP. The recipients are going to get real ESPY awards, the exact same award that they give out at the ESPYs for their different awards. They're going to get it here in Kansas City. That is really cool. Go to 810WHP.com or hit social media with the hashtag 810ESPYs, hashtag 810ESPYs. We will take a break. Coming up next, Keith Law will be with us in the program. Our Need to Know brought to you by our friends at Twin Peaks. They're open, Olathe and Independence. Good news, same great scenic views and the same great made-from-scratch food and the same great ice-cold 29-degree beer. You can get it right now at Twin Peaks. Be patient, though. Limited seating. There are guidelines that they have to work through. So I know everybody wants to rush back into the best place to watch a game in town, right, or just watch TV in town or just hang out with friends. But remember, there are certain guidelines they've got to do. And, of course, they are still open for curbside delivery as well. In Olathe, you can call them at 913-768-0028. In Independence, it's 816-795-7710. All your favorites are available to go and delivery as well. Go to TwinPeaksRestaurant.com. That's TwinPeaksRestaurant.com to place your order. Twin Peaks, eats, drinks, scenic views.
The program with Soren Petro.
They look in your eyes and you see the back of their head. You know, it's a real glaring look, and they're like this, you know, a little bit nervous.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
You know. Welcome back here on the program here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Let's talk some baseball. The draft rolling around June 10th and 11th. No one better to talk to about the sport of baseball, really, in any way, shape, or form than our next guest, Keith Law from The Athletic, senior baseball writer, author as well. You know, Father's Day is right around the corner. If Dad loves baseball, loves reading about baseball, Keith Law's books are absolutely fantastic. His latest book is called The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves. You can get it right now. Keith Law with us on the Sprint Guest Line. Keith, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. Are we really going to see a Major League Baseball draft that has a first baseman going 1-1? That doesn't happen much.
It's never happened to have a college first baseman go 1-1. I think the last first baseman of any sort to go 1-1 was Adrian Gonzalez 20 years ago. Maybe I'm forgetting somebody in the interim, but I think he's the last one. I think Spencer Torkelson goes first overall. I would not guarantee it. I'd say maybe you were at about 80% chance of that happening. I personally would take Austin Martin of Vanderbilt, who's a third baseman and center fielder. He's a better athlete. He's got elite bat speed. He does not have Torkelson's raw power. Torkelson's been kind of famous since he first set foot on campus at Arizona State. That may also be driving this a little bit. I don't think either guy is a wrong choice, but I prefer to go for upside and a little more athleticism. I think Austin Martin offers that over Torkelson.
If a first baseman is going to go 1-1 in this draft, does that mean that this is a weaker draft class or at least weaker at the top?
No, I would actually say the opposite. I think this is a really good draft class. It's a particularly good college draft class. The college pitching crop is extremely deep, but teams are thinking very conservatively this year because, obviously, of the economic situation, because they didn't get to scout anybody. We only had 4 weekends of college baseball. Some high schools got to play a few weeks. Some high schools never got to start their seasons at all. And so teams are generally, with a few exceptions, taking a more conservative tactic, whether that is trying to just go college or trying to maybe even save money across the board and spend less than their allotted bonus pools. And that's probably going to drive the most college-heavy first round maybe that we've ever seen, certainly in the last 10 years.
Does that mean we're going to see like college baseball totally fatten up, particularly with only 5 rounds and only a $20,000 max after those 5 rounds for anyone who isn't drafted? Is college baseball going to be the great benefactor of this?
I think so, but I have also speculated, again, just sort of me trying to look in a crystal ball here, so don't put too much stock in it. But my speculation is that a lot of high school players who were in sort of that second, third tier of high school prospects may choose to go to junior college rather than going to four-year schools, especially because some four-year school players are going to end up going back to school. They get another year of eligibility. That kid who would have been drafted in the sixth to eighth round, he may go back to school, and he plays again. He's still taking up a scholarship. He's taking up playing time. Maybe some incoming freshmen, some recruits, say, you know, I'm going to go to junior college and try again next year. And frankly, I would recommend it. If any parents called me to ask about what their kids should do, and I thought their kid was kind of in that situation where he might have been a $600,000 guy, that guy's not getting drafted this year. I would say, if you're comfortable with it, go to junior college. You even get to save some money, stay close to home. You will get scouted. Teams are going to be out going to see those players next year. Teams love junior college guys because there's just so much flexibility there, and they're pretty easy to go see and scout. So I think that it's possible that the two-year schools will be the biggest beneficiaries of all.
We're talking right now to Keith Law, of course, former assistant general manager to the Toronto Blue Jays. You can read his work at The Athletic. So you mentioned could be Torkelson, could be Martin. With Baltimore at number two, that's the first team that you know, maybe signing, maybe drafting a guy below slot and, you know, saving some money to come back with their next pick at 30 and go after a guy. How likely are you? How much is it Baltimore's an either-or with one of those two players, or how real do you think the rumors are that they could go slot?
I think they'll end up taking the best player available. I just have heard rumors that they're entertaining this possibility of going to take somebody and cut them and try to go under slot and then go over. Because Baltimore, same situation as Kansas City, each of those teams picks again in the competitive balance round and then at the top of the second round. So Baltimore has three picks inside of the top 40. If they chose to do so, they could try to save some money with the at that number two overall pick, then come back at pick 30, I think is their next pick, mm-hmm. go over slot, and then try to do it again at pick 39, I think is their next pick. By going under slot at two, they could go over slot with the next two picks and potentially walk out of this with two or even three first-round talents. That's a strategy. I don't know that that's necessarily the right strategy when there is going to be a pretty high ceiling, high impact player like Torkelson or Martin available to you at the second pick. It's different if you're Kansas City. Kansas City picks fourth, and it's kind of like a three-man top tier in the draft class with Torkelson, Martin, and the lefty of Texas A&M, Asa Lacy. If you're Kansas City and those three guys are gone, then it might make sense to try to go get a discount because you have those two extra picks and maybe you can go over later. Go over slot with one or both of those subsequent picks.
How big a drop-off is it? I mean, this draft seems to remind me of when they took Bubba Starling at five. There were four pitchers that the consensus was the Royals would be thrilled if any one of those four dropped to them. They did, and it was, you know, Bauer and Cole. Dylan Bundy was in that draft. None of those guys made it down to them. They ended up taking Bubba Starling. That ended up being a pretty big drop-off. Is this a massive drop-off or, you know, no, it's just definitively a step down?
Danny Hulston was the fourth guy in that draft class, too. He went second, and he did make the majors, but he blew out almost immediately. And I don't think they wouldn't have been any better off if they'd gotten Hulston than if they got Bubba Starling. Turns out, in hindsight, the guy they should have taken was Francisco Lindor.
Right.
This year, I don't think it's that big of a drop-off, but it's a drop-off. Like, I want to be honest. I think that there's a drop after those first three guys to whoever you decide is the next best player. The guy I've heard them linked to repeatedly now for several weeks is Zach Veen, the best high school position player prospect in terms of overall prospect. Hitting for power, defensive ability, center fielder now, he's going to end up in right field. But the thought is that if they didn't take him, he'd probably slip to at least the eighth pick, and you could go to Zach Veen and say, we'll pay you the slot figure for pick number seven, which would still save the Royals more than $1 million. And that's more than Veen's going to get from anybody else. So it's kind of a win-win for both sides. Then they can take probably, say, $1.5 million in savings and apply that to those next two picks, a competitive balance A pick and their second-round pick, and get at least one more player who's first-round caliber but doesn't go in the first round because maybe he wants more money than teams in the first round, especially in the late first round, are willing to pay him.
The name, and I'll come back to Zach Veen here in a second, the name that was being thrown around for the Royals a lot was Nick Gonzalez, and he was a guy that at one point was even being talked about as potentially the number one guy. What is it about Gonzalez that has him on the slide and why he wouldn't be the Royals' choice?
I think a lot of the Nick Gonzalez thing is fans probably just looking at superficial stats. Gonzalez hit 5 home runs in one day in a doubleheader this spring. Gonzalez plays at New Mexico State. They're 4,000 feet above sea level. And when Gonzalez had to play a series against a real school, they're also New Mexico State. They don't play in a major conference. They did play Texas A&M, I think their last season of the spring, and they did it at College Station in Texas. So they were playing at sea level. And Nick Gonzalez got de-pantsed by better pitching. He really didn't look good. It's not a great swing. He's not actually a power hitter. He's not a very big guy. And he's a college second baseman. And the history of college second baseman going high in the draft is actually not very good. Most major league second basemen who were drafted out of the college ranks actually were shortstops. And Gonzalez has played a little bit of shortstop, but more second base, and he's clearly not a shortstop at the next level. I'm not sure I would take Gonzalez with a top 10 pick. And I have been told, sort of through talking to other scouts, that it's not that the Royals actively dislike Gonzalez, but that he's just not their kind of guy. And I would agree with that. And I think they can do better. I think Veen's a better player. I think either of the next best, there's probably 3 other college pitchers I would consider before Gonzalez. I might even consider Heston Kjerstad, the Arkansas outfielder, who has some risk of his own but has a lot more upside, before taking Gonzalez if I were picking 4th.
I had no problem, because that was my big fear. If a guy's already been moved to second base in college, I mean, what does that say for what he's going to be when he gets up there? I mean, we've lived through Christian Colon. You know, he was a shortstop, and, you know, we saw, you looked at him, you're like, wow, he was never going to be a shortstop in the big leagues when he got up. So to me, I was actually happy to see that. The high school outfielder thing does scare me. I mean, we were burnt, and I hope he has a fine career. Bubba Starling's a local kid. I root for him. But you know, the high school outfielder, how difficult is it to project what Veen's going to be, and how does he compare? I compare and contrast, because he also, when you see 6'4", and, you know, can play center field, he sounds like he's a lot like Bubba Starling.
He is more lean and baseball built than Starling. Starling had football strength, too. So in terms of pure athleticism, Starling's probably a better runner, but Veen was more agile, more baseball athletic. You know, there's athleticism in sort of a general sense, but there are specific things that we're looking more for in baseball that translate better. In baseball, Veen's got looser hands. He's got a much, much better swing. And Bubba Starling's number one problem in pro baseball was that his swing seemed to change every 20 minutes. And for a guy who never had great pitch recognition to begin with, that was pretty much a fatal flaw. I think Veen is better pretty much across the board. At the plate, he's definitely a better defender. He's got a great arm, probably a better throwing motion than Bubba Starling did, although Starling has a good arm. He was not necessarily he's a quarterback, right? That's a different throwing motion. A lot of quarterbacks have a hard time translating from one sport to the other, because we're asking you to throw obviously a different ball, but throw with very different mechanics. So I feel better about Veen going out and producing right away. I will say, though, to your broader point, he's a high school outfielder. There's risk. We've seen him swing and miss. We've seen Veen swing and miss against good competition as a high school player. We've also seen him mash. I saw him. I was at probably his second or third to last game before the shutdown, and he hit a ball that probably hasn't even come down yet, and it's a gorgeous swing. And the body is great. This is what they're supposed to look like. The one thing you never know with a high school position player, no matter where he's from, is how well he's going to recognize pitches when he gets into pro ball. It's just a big difference between seeing high school breaking balls and then seeing professional-level breaking balls, even at the lowest level of the minors. And you just don't really know until he gets out there.
Keith Law is with us here in the program. You've got Veen going 4 in your mock draft 2.0, which people can find at The Athletic. Is that what you would pick? It sounds like that is who you would pick for the Royals. Or is that who you think they're going to pick, or both?
I would probably, not knowing signability, on a lot of guys, too, because that would affect a lot of my draft strategy. But if we're just saying who's the best player available, I might take Max Meyer, who's a 6-foot right-hander out of the University of Minnesota. He's been up to 99 with a slider up to 93. Absolute wipeout pitch. Good delivery, good athlete. If he's 6'2", we're probably talking about him going 1st overall. So to me, I'm not overly bothered by the 6 foot right hander thing as long as the mechanics are good. He's got a track record of health, and he does. And I think Meyer, there's some immediate potential return. I had him in my mock going to the Padres and saying what I've heard, so that they'd like to take him and then maybe bring him to the big leagues this year as a reliever, and then eventually develop him as a starter in the long term. I think he's got the best chance of helping a big league club this year, probably anybody in the entire draft class, but also brings you the upside of a starter down the road. It'd be very hard for me to pass that up, assuming 1-2-3 goes the way that I predicted it.
How does he compare to Tim Lincecum? I remember talking to Howard Baird, and Lincecum was on. The Royals had the number one pick in that draft. He ended up being let go and didn't end up making the draft. But I think the conversations we had, he was talking Lincecum, Scherzer, Andrew Miller for the number one overall pick. Miller was the consensus number one guy in that draft. But, you know, he brought up Lincecum and how he thought he was going to be really good. He said it's going to be rough, though, to go take a sub-6-foot right-hander with the number one overall pick. As we know, Lincecum didn't have the length to his career, but nobody would have complained about the career that Tim Lincecum had he gone 1-1. Has this kid got that kind of upside?
They're very different. I think Max Meyer could be really, really good for a long time. Lincecum was smaller, probably more flexible, and had one of the most unusual deliveries we've ever seen. But he'd been throwing that way since he was 7 or 8 years old and never did, really, until his career essentially ended in pro ball. He never did have an arm injury. It wasn't until he'd just kind of been, I think, worn out from some very heavy usage. He never did get hurt. Meyer is different. I mean, Tim Lincecum won 2 Cy Young Awards. I don't want to hang that on any kid in this draft. But do I think Meyer could be a number one or number two starter? Yeah, it's in there. It's absolutely in there. I mean, we've seen Sonny Gray have some pretty elite seasons. You've seen Marcus Stroman have elite seasons. Meyer is taller and bigger than both of those guys and is, I'd say, almost as good, if not as good an athlete as either of those guys, especially Stroman, who's a really, really good athlete. You know, Meyer has that, too. And if we're talking about betting on a smaller right-handed pitcher, I want athleticism, and I want a delivery I can believe in. Lincecum, a lot of people didn't believe in the delivery because it was so unusual. I thought Lincecum's biggest problem in college was that he just walked a ton of guys, and he really had a hard time keeping the delivery together and still throwing strikes when it came to 80, 90, or 100 pitches in a game. That got better as he got bigger and older and stronger. Meyer doesn't have that obstacle. He's already throwing strikes. So I feel like you could probably even use him pretty quickly in the major leagues, which, again, I think is the Padres' idea if they do draft him with the 8th pick.
Yeah, I would love to have read your scouting report on Tim Lincecum's delivery. You know, his sidearm but bends all the way to the left, which makes it over the top, yeah. But he's throwing with his chest. You know, I don't know how you would write
that
one up.
I was with the Blue Jays at the time. The last time I saw him twice as an amateur, and I compared it to a catapult. I mean, it really was like sort of way back and kind of up over the top. That's how he got the ridiculous depth on the curveball. And he could tell guys he was throwing the curveball, and they'd still swing right over the top of it. But it worked. And when you saw him, and I saw him in a 2-inning stint where he came in, started out the first 5 guys on basically the same pitch sequence: fastball for a strike, fastball up, breaking ball down, strikeout. And finally, the sixth guy just said, "I'm swinging at the first fastball I see," which was probably a good strategy. Now, I saw him make a start a couple of days later, and he couldn't keep the delivery together. He got through about 5 innings or so, and he was fine. But you could see him start to come out of the delivery. I think he needed to get stronger. He was just kind of undersized and didn't have the strength to keep the delivery together for 80, 90 pitches. When he got stronger, that was no longer an issue. And that was where I went wrong, too. I said, he can't keep his delivery together now, and didn't forecast that he would be able to do so down the line as he filled out physically.
Two more quick points before I give you the final four and get you going, Keith. And that is, what are the Royals? Just basically, I mean, I feel like the Royals are the team that's being hurt the most by the pandemic, because they're a team that's already bottomed and crashed all the way out as far as how far down they got to go to take off. And now they're not getting innings and at-bats for all their young players. Is there any team hurt worse than the Royals?
That's a good question. Tampa Bay, a team that's just highly dependent on player development, needed some of those guys to continue to get at-bats, continue to get innings. I put the Royals in that category. The Padres are hurt but may also be helped in that the Padres are probably more competitive in a 60-game season than they would have been in 162, and they could sort of push their chips in towards the center of the table now. But they're also a team that's very dependent on player development, has a very strong farm system, but with a lot of guys who are still kind of on the come and needed those repetitions. Those are the teams I think really are most impacted, where you don't have the money to paper over stuff at the major league level. You really need your farm system to keep developing. We're basically losing a year of development for all players who aren't going to appear in the majors or play on some sort of taxi squad this year.
And finally, why is the relationship between owners and players in baseball worse than the relationship between owners and players in any other sport?
I think the baseball union is so much stronger, and owners in baseball don't like it. I mean, the football owners just run roughshod over the union every time there's any sort of negotiation. The relationship in the NBA is very different. That union's smaller. That has been a much more collegial relationship. I know there's been some labor strife there over the years, too, but it does seem like owners in that sport are maybe more in tune with what players want, and there's that you see that league speaking with one voice far more than any of the other major sports leagues here in the United States. But in baseball, it's just that our union is still pretty strong. They didn't do a great job in the last CBA negotiation, but I think they're determined to remedy some of that this time around, and that's also why they're trying to set a tone here. In addition to getting things players want, if there is going to be a season this year, they're trying to set a very specific tone to say we're not going to be walked all over in the next CBA negotiations like we kind of were last time.
We're talking to Keith Law here in the program. Time for our Final Four, brought to you by Applause Custom Sight and Sound. Find them online at applausetheater.com. Four quickies, Keith. First one, what's the worst contract in Major League Baseball right now?
I think it's Miguel Cabrera's. I'm pretty sure I'll retire before that contract is up, and he might be done.
Yeah, yes, and I think there's just over $100 million left after this year. After this year on Miggy's deal. That is a good one. Will we have a work stoppage after the 21 season?
No, I don't think so. For the same reason, I think we're going to have a season this year. There's just too much money at stake. It may not be the season we wanted it. Both sides are probably going to be unhappy with whatever they agree to. But ultimately, there's so much money at stake that for either side to have us not play or to have a work stoppage is, I'd say, unlikely. Never say impossible, but they have strong incentives for us to have a season.
All right. I asked you this before, so I like to check back in with all the sports we've lost. Are you binge-watching any good shows?
Never Have I Ever on Netflix was absolutely amazing. It's a sort of smart teen comedy. I have a teenage daughter, too. Watched it with her, which is rare. She loves to watch old movies with us. A lot of more current stuff kind of makes her cringe a little bit to watch that with adults in the room. So I think that's probably the best series that I've watched. I'm also now three-quarters of the way through Catastrophe, which is not new, but my partner insisted that I watch it because it's maybe her all-time favorite show.
Ah, I like that. Okay, I got two good ones. I got a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old daughter. So for the 13-year-old, I love getting that advice. That's one of my favorites to hear. All right, and finally, the Royals. For whatever reason, every pitcher looks really good. You're in Delaware, by the way. Every pitcher looks really good at Frawley Stadium, where the Blue Rocks play. Every hitter struggles, as we know last year's minor league crop did. Why is it so hard to hit at Frawley Stadium?
If you ask the hitters, they'll tell you it's because it's distracting to have I-95, which the protesters here actually blocked pretty close to where that is during protests on the peaceful protests we had here in Wilmington on Saturday. They'll tell you it's distracting to have the cars out there. I think that's kind of ridiculous. I actually think the bigger reason is it sits right on the waterfront. It's kind of low. The air is a little heavy, so it's hard to lift the ball and drive it out of the park. It's not that hard to hit at Frawley Stadium. We've seen plenty of guys come through here and hit. Nicky Lopez had no issues hitting here, but it's hard to hit for power. And I think that has everything to do with where this stadium's located and nothing to do with the traffic on the highway.
All right. I like it. That's the best answer I've ever heard. I usually get them from Keith Law. Again, Father's Day right around the corner. His new book is called The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves. I encourage you to get it for any baseball fan out there. And, of course, we love The Athletic here. You absolutely have to have a subscription. Keith is one of those guys that his work alone is worth the price of that subscription. Keith, thanks so much for giving us some time, and stay safe, stay healthy. We hope to talk to you down the road.
My pleasure.
The Program with Soren Petro.
I like pancakes. I like pancakes. I am happy. I am happy. La, 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 la.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB. We're almost done for the day, but there's just a few more things we'd like to share.
But there's still more.
Here's the kicker.
Here's the kicker of this whole thing.
On The Program.
But first, a good sense, end of the hour answer. Since 1931, three players have had a 240-hit season. Ichiro is one. He did it twice. Name either of the other two.
Since what year?
Since 31. Chuck Klein did it in 1930. And since 31.
You're taking Hornsby out of the mix, too.
Yep.
Hornsby, I know nothing other than what I read, although wasn't he supposed to be kind of an SOB?
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Okay, so.
Bit of a
when I look at his numbers, I look at him and I go, I think that's the player I would have been had I stuck with baseball.
Yeah.
424 and 37 dingers. Yeah, that's me. That's
super
me.
High average homers. Yeah. Ribbies. Yeah. I think it's what been.
I think he's actually underrated as a matter of fact.
I absolutely think he is.
Those numbers are insane.
It's nuts. Look at his 22 and 24 seasons, whatever the years that he went to. Just ridiculous.
Unreal. All right. I got no idea.
Would you like the years of the two good players?
Yeah, one of two players that have 240 hits or more since 1931. Yeah, give me the years.
1985.
Well, G. Brett didn't get that far. He walked too many times.
215 was his career high. 2000. One guy's in the Hall of Fame. One guy is not, but did play for a world championship team.
85 and 2000. Not in the Hall of Fame, but played for a world championship team. Is that the 2000 guy?
Mm-hmm. Notable for...
Lenny Dykstra?
Nah. He was on... he was notable for
that
his...
That big year with the Phillies.
Oh, yeah. Now, he was notable for his exploits in college football in a Midwestern school.
Kirk Gibson.
Played center field on a world championship team.
College football?
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing something obvious. There's somebody I'm going to kick myself. I don't know. Who is it?
Darren Erstad.
Oh, I had a question about him today that I didn't get to.
I couldn't believe he had a 240-hit season.
Punters are not playing college football.
Yeah.
That does not count. Zing. That's like
shots fired.
Good,
wow.
Good point.
It's a punting. It's sorry, punting. Dustin. It's punting. I know Dustin Colquitt's one of the great punters of all time.
He just went,
It's just like In trivia world, when like, you played college football, you don't think like, let me go through the punters, long snappers, and kickers first.
Let's see, Tommy Frazier? No, it wasn't him. The other guy is a Hall of Famer, mid-80s.
Yeah, Erstad, this 85. One monster, he hit 355. I was just looking at him the other night. Incredible. I had a question about him today. 1985. Who am I missing in 85? That had a monster year. I'm going to kick myself on that one, too. I don't kick myself first at, but who's this one?
Wade Boggs.
Oh, well, he's in the Hall of Fame.
That's what I said. So one guy's in the Hall of Fame, the other guy isn't.
Oh, okay. I guess I screwed that up on my own. Hey, it's been a long week. It's been a long day.
By the way, Erstad 46 today. That's why I wanted that. It was the departure point.
I don't know where I came across Erstad. I came across him somewhere, and I had something for him. It was old. I'll use it next week. Good stuff. Great stuff at GoodSense. GoodSenseSubs.com. Order it right now. Slicing the meats and cheeses fresh. Baking the bread fresh twice each day. That's GoodSense. Also, their GoodSense To-Go meals. Very, very popular. Go to GoodSenseSubs.com. Listen, a couple of things. One, they've come up with a date on when you got to withdraw your name from the NBA draft. August 3rd. Or 10 days after the NBA draft combine, whichever comes first. They're still working that out. But we know we'll find out who ends up pulling their name out. The NBA G League has canceled the remainder of their season, but they are going to pay the players for the 17 days that were left on the season, and they have extended their health benefits. The NBA seems to get it there. They approved the 22-team format for the NBA finish in Orlando, Florida. The vote, 29-1. The Blazers said, screw that. No, we pass.
They're not down.
I'm not sure what their rub was. NASCAR will return to Kansas Speedway, originally scheduled for May. They will now be slated the 23rd through the 25th. And the big race, the NASCAR race, is going to be on Thursday night, the 23rd. So night racing at Kansas Speedway. We will see you tomorrow on Thursday night.
WHB.